This is Circe Olson-Westner. I'm the director of the Museum of the American Military Family in Tejeros, New Mexico, and this is our podcast, Together We Serve. Our museum is proud to have collected hundreds of interviews, many of which are available here on our MAMF Media podcast, and we also have several blogs. I'll put the links down below for you to check out later. Today we're speaking with Army veteran Greg Hallmark via phone. He's in Tennessee, and it is a pandemic, so most of our interviews are being done by phone these days. So hi, Greg.
Hey, sir.
Hey. So I know you from our museum's most recent anthology project. So it's a book about the armored cavalry in Cold War Germany, and you submitted a story about your experience about being on freedom's frontier. How long did you serve in the military? Tell our listeners about that.
I served one tour of duty in the Army, mm-hmm. 3 years, mm-hmm. From 1976 to 1979.
Mm-hmm. So what have you done since you got out in 79?
Well, lived a life. lived a couple of them. It's maybe three. I guess the first thing I did when I got out was go to college.
Mm-hmm.
I went to LSU in Shreveport, my hometown,
mm-hmm.
on the GI Bill,
mm-hmm.
and got in the communications business, and I moved to Nashville a few years later, mm-hmm. 1987. I've been here ever since. Married, got two grown daughters now.
Mm-hmm.
We're, I guess you'd call us empty nesters at this point.
Us too.
Started a business mm-hmm. About 20 years ago, a web development business that I still have.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, just lived a life.
Well, that's interesting, communications, because I think that your story is beautiful, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later. So why did you join the Army? You only stayed in for a few years, but why did you choose to join the Army? And then also, what did your family say when you decided to join?
Yeah. Well, my mom was pretty upset. Yeah, I was 17, and I was actually a pretty immature 17. Mm-hmm. I'm the baby of the family, and I think it. I was. I mean, all told, I was probably really too young to mm-hmm. go in the Army, and I think she knew it.
Mm-hmm.
But I was gonna do it. Nevertheless, my dad was okay with it. He's a veteran, World War II veteran. He's passed on.
Mm-hmm.
As far as why I did it, it really, you gotta understand kind of the context of the times. It was post Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
Vietnam, even though it had only been over for 4 or 5 years,
mm-hmm.
By that time, by 1976, Vietnam really kind of seemed like ancient history.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There really was no probability of being in a shooting war.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I think that kind of helped my mom in her decision to sign for me to go. They had to sign a release or something, because I was 17 as opposed to 18. But as far as personal reasons why I joined, it was kind of, I guess you could say it was either that or, you know, run off with the circus. I was really kind of in the mode of spinning my wheels in high school. And I wasn't really doing that well. I was bored. I was in a place I didn't want to be
mm-hmm.
anymore, mm-hmm. out in the country in Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
I needed some adventure.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. It was just kind of a gut feeling. And, you know, also, I always wanted to go to Europe, specifically Germany for some reason. I'd always had a fascination with Germany and German history and, you know, just the old world. Always kind of interested. The idea of it was intriguing to me. And there was no earthly way I would ever get over there otherwise.
Right.
My parents weren't really in a situation to even pay for college, leave alone, you know, let me go on some elaborate trip. So it was just kind of like, what the hell? Let's do it. Just kind of plunged in and sink or swim.
Yeah, yeah.
And I did it.
So this made me think of something. So had your dad gone overseas during the war?
Oh, yeah, yeah. He was at the Battle of Okinawa in the Pacific, which was one of the big battles. He was of that generation, you know, the greatest generation.
Right.
Both my parents were.
Right.
So he had definitely seen some action and had been wounded and that kind of thing. I had an older brother, much older brother, who had been in the Navy. So a little bit of a history of service in our family.
Well, I was thinking maybe your father, having seen Germany, influenced you, but I guess not.
No, he was on the other
side. On the other side, yeah. So after basic, it's 1977, and you're now, I assume, 18 years old, and you landed in Germany. What was your first impression? Did it live up to your expectations? And then, yeah.
Yeah, I would say yes. I remember my very first impression was from the air. Coming in on the plane into Frankfurt, and it was at night or early morning, and looking out of the window and seeing the sprawling ancient streets of Frankfurt lit up, looking so different even from that vantage point than the American cities that I was used to. And then I guess there was, you know, after the dust settled and we got sorted, we got sent to the replacement battalion in Frankfurt.
Right.
And I remember just standing out in the street in front of it, just looking at this everyday street life in Frankfurt. The cars are different. People dress differently. Of course, everyone spoke a different language, but, you know, very sophisticated city. And I'm from kind of the opposite end of the spectrum from anything sophisticated.
Right.
it was pretty cool. I liked it a lot. But it was, you know, incredibly different. There was culture shock, you know, no question about it.
Yeah. So did somebody pick you up in a bus and drive you off to, I guess, Bad Kissingen? Were you met, or did you have to find your way?
No. We were at the replacement battalion, I think, for a couple of days. You had to kind of go through a process, if I remember correctly, a process of getting sort of your orders as to where you would go. They finally assigned me the 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment, the 2nd Squadron of the Black Horse Regiment. And they told me it was in this place called Bad Kissingen. And it was a resort town. I thought, well, that sounds
great. Yeah.
But there was a guy I came over. Actually, I came over with I think 5 guys from my AIT unit at Fort Leonard Woods, and all but me and one other fella went elsewhere. And so me and one of my guys, my friends, got assigned to BK. And And every, you know, basically they put us on a train. There's quite a few of us that ended up going up to BK. And we rode the train.
Wow.
Yeah, it was the first time I'd ever been on a train.
Yeah, I was going to say, so this is like a whole bunch of firsts. It's a strange country, your first time on a train. I would have been a little terrified. So what was your first memory of the cavalry? You arrived in Bad Kissingen, and what happened?
Okay. Well, it was, I guess, the first sort of impression. A corporal, I forget his name, but I can still see him. I think his first name was Leonard. Anyway, he met us at the train station and had, I guess, a vehicle, probably a truck, like a deuce and a half, that we all got in the back of, and he drove us a few miles from the train station to the post, Daily Barracks, and it was also night when I arrived there, and it was an interesting sort of sight. The barracks at Daily Barracks originally were Wehrmacht barracks, barracks for the German Army during World War II, as a lot of the barracks over there during the Cold War were. We just repurposed a lot of German barracks. And it had a real distinct sort of look to it, kind of Gothic. A lot of, GIs. It was after working hours, so there was a lot of GIs kind of walking up and down the street, and windows open with their music playing. It's kind of like, in a way, it's sort of like a college environment. I mean, there's the quadrangle, which we call the parade field.
Yeah.
Of course, and the barracks surrounding it, which were kind of like dorms.
Right.
It kind of had that vibe to it. I guess it kind of slowly dawned on me that, man, I'm really young here, I'm like a child. I mean, there's, these are grown men.
Right.
and I'm just a little squirt, it was a little, I would say more than a little. It was actually pretty intimidating.
And so then once you got it settled, I guess, in the barracks, the next day you had sort of an indoctrination as to what your job would be, what your mission was?
I knew what my job would be. I was in the transportation world. I'd gone to truck driving school at Fort Leonard Wood. That was my MOS. Back then it was called 64 Charlie. Which was basically completely different than everybody else on the post, which, everyone else was either a tanker or a scout. It's a real, kind of battle-ready unit.
Right.
And a lot of these guys had been in Vietnam. And, I mean, they were warriors. But I was a driver. And I was assigned to headquarters troop, HHT, 2nd 11, where all the kind of the administrative, like the non-combat stuff was, and including the support platoon, which I was in what was called the support platoon, which was a platoon of drivers. We drove various vehicles. So we were kind of like different from the rest of the unit in that regard. So I knew going in I was going to be driving something. whether it be a Jeep or a, you know, mm-hmm. semi or a, you know, a right. bus or what, or whatever. I didn't know, but eventually, you know, I was assigned my 5-ton truck, and that's what I drove.
So you finally got to see the Iron Curtain, the infamous Iron Curtain, in up in Bad Hersfeld, where we were. Of course, it was a fence, not like the Berlin Wall. So what did you think? And could you really comprehend the magnitude of what that fence represented? I mean, this was so out of your worldview anyway, but now you're looking at the communist hordes.
Well, you know, it's kind of funny. I never knew mm-hmm. of a world mm-hmm. that didn't have the Iron Curtain or the Berlin Wall. I mean, you know, I guess the Berlin Wall was built, what, 62, 63 or something?
Yeah, in the 60s, yeah.
I was born in 58. You know, by the time I had a real consciousness of the world, it was an established fact. I mean, it's just kind of the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't expect to go there. Mm-hmm. I didn't expect to live on it mm-hmm. for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
It was just an accepted thing. I mean, I guess it would be no different. I don't know how to describe. Well, one way that I've described it in the past, mm-hmm. I never would have thought there wouldn't be an Iron Curtain. Mm-hmm. I couldn't dream of it. I didn't even consider that it would ever go away. I mean, to me, it was permanent. I mean, it was the way it is. You know? You know, it's kind of like, you know, the Grand Canyon, man. It's just there.
Right. Well, and it had been around long enough that you'd learned about it in school, East Germany and West Germany.
Definitely. Yeah, you know, in the news.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was a known thing. So I wasn't shocked by it. You know, I didn't sit there. I wasn't just blown away by it.
Right.
But it was ominous, mm-hmm. you know, to really see it. Mm-hmm. It was like, you know, really, I mean, this is serious business here,
right.
People can die and have died mm-hmm. On this thing.
Mm-hmm.
A war could very, I mean, it, you know, the end of the world could mm-hmm. occur mm-hmm. right here. you know, where we were at, if you were at Hertzfeld, you know, the Fulda Gap was the thing that the Black Horse Regiment was guarding and patrolling, and that is where, if there was going to be a ground war, World War III, that's more than likely where it would begin. So it was just kind of like blind luck. You know, mm-hmm. or just mm-hmm. luck of the draw or whatever, that I ended up there in that particular place. You know, my other friends from base, they went to Germany. You know, they got stationed in, like, Mannheim or Frankfurt or Stuttgart, you know, and they had a completely different experience in their service time over in Germany than I did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the thing with the Black Horse Regiment was we were combat, I mean, we were ready for war. And as opposed to some of the units further back.
Right.
And, I mean, we were on constant alert. It was hard duty. And there was no fooling around, man. I mean, it was a hardcore unit.
So that gets me to my question then. So did your unit did the units rotate out to OPs and did you ferry? Okay, so explain a little bit to our listeners about that, the OP life.
Well, you know there were where I was in the second squadron.
Mm-hmm.
There were four troops in the armored cavalry, mm-hmm. An armored cavalry regiment, you don't have companies.
Right.
You have troops. They call them troops. Mm-hmm. I was in headquarters troop, HHT. Mm-hmm. And then there were three other troops. I'm probably missing out on a couple other ones. I'm not an expert.
Right.
And the three or four, might have been four, basically the tank units mm-hmm. would rotate pulling duty mm-hmm. on the border,
mm-hmm.
all right, a border duty, all
mm-hmm.
right.
Mm-hmm.
I never, we supplied the border mm-hmm. as mm-hmm. opposed, we never got a week or a month on the border because we were supporting all of the troops, including the ones on the border. So I didn't spend as much time at Camp Lee mm-hmm. as, you know, the tankers.
Mm-hmm.
I'd go out there,
mm-hmm.
but I'd come back. You know, mm-hmm. I'd go out there with a load of whatever,
mm-hmm.
pies or, you know, sea rations or
right.
ammo or letters or whatever. But, you know, I'd just kind of spend the day out there and come back, mostly.
Mm-hmm.
The next day I may be going to Fulda or Frankfurt or Stuttgart or Schweinfurt,
So you got
something up or take somebody or drop something off or whatever. So I was kind of all over the place.
And you got to see a lot of Germany that you might not have seen just based on your job of driving.
Yeah. And sometimes I wonder how many miles I drove in Germany. It was, had to be, you know, thousands of miles in those 3 years. I was on the road a lot. I was on the Autobahn a lot. I was on those little twisties.
Yeah.
You know, Bernese a lot. I drove a lot. Quite a bit.
I was going to say, you know, coming from the States and you're 18, you're probably not, and you already said you were a young 18, dealing with the Autobahn, you know, that's,
yeah.
that was, you know.
Well, you know, one of the advantages of being 18 is that you're not scared of much of anything.
Yeah.
And, you know, you think you're going to live forever.
Yeah.
I don't really remember being freaked out by the Autobahn. Even though the 5 tons that we drove, and I think most military vehicles, definitely the 5 tons and the deuce and a half, had a governor on it that would prevent you from going over 60 miles an hour. Which is kind of weird when you think there are cars that are passing you that are going 150 miles an hour.
Right.
I have to say, it didn't bother me. As a matter of fact, I loved it. I loved the Autobahn, and I loved being able to, you know, see that part of Europe.
Did you have the opportunity to interact with any Germans, either working
Oh, definitely. Well, not working, but
or living on the border.
I had quite a number of German friends, girlfriends, and guys.
Mm-hmm.
I ended up, you know, after the first year that I was in BK, I lived off post. And I rented a place from a German man. And I kind of went native.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I sort of learned the language mm-hmm. enough, you know,
mm-hmm.
to converse.
Mm-hmm.
The way it kind of shook out for me was the first year. And you got to think back when you were 18, how long 3 years was. I mean, that was like a long stretch of time.
Right.
To an 18-year-old.
Mm.
The first year was culture shock.
Mm.
And, I mean, it was really hard. And, I mean, I hadn't been many places by the time I joined the Army. I had been a little, you know, a few, I'd spent a couple of weeks in Los Angeles one summer, that kind of thing. But I'd never been to like New York or Chicago or and none of that stuff, you know. So it was really a shock, culture shock. I mean, the language, of course, and everything was just so different. The people were different. The social norms were different. So it was a little bit of a painful cultural shock period for almost the first year. But after that, at some point, something clicked, and I went 180 degrees opposite. I loved it. I mean, I loved my German friends. I really started to understand the culture. I started to learn more about the history. I began to see how beautiful it was. I loved it. And I had quite a number of German friends.
So you know, I grew up in Germany, so it was just always my life. And I was surprised at one point when a German person said, "You Americans are occupying us." And I was like, "No, we're not. We're just living here." And then, you know, now I was like, "Well, yeah." So how did your German friends and contacts feel about the Americans being there?
Well, there was, I would say my friends, okay, my personal friends, German friends, it really wasn't a thing to them. For one thing, they were all about my age, and it was all they knew. I mean, it wasn't anything that was, like, you know, new to them. I mean, it was the way life was. They were Americans. And I didn't have, as I recall, I didn't have any, like, real political German friends, except for one, okay? And it was a girlfriend that I had. Her name's Catherine. And she was one of these political German kids who called herself a communist. There was kind of a little cultural thing back then. If you wanted to be a real rebel in West Germany, you know, you call yourself a communist or whatever, and actually kind of act like you believe it or what have you, which always struck me as kind of weird. I'm like, well, you know, why aren't you on the other side of that fence? There's a whole bunch of people who are communists over there. Why don't you go live with them? You know, I mean, it's just right there. You know, you could, I'm sure they would let you in. You know, I always found it kind of ironic. You know, here you are living on the west side with all these freedoms and everything, and this incredibly successful economy. She drove a beautiful, brand new BMW. I'm like, what kind of communist are you, really? But it was really just a pose, you know. It was just something that I think make her parents mad, more or less, just like all teenagers sometimes. One thing though that I did notice, when we would travel, you know, I had a good friend who was in my platoon who was born in Germany. He was German, but he was in the American Army. His parents had moved to the States like when he was 8 or 9, and he was an American citizen, but he had spent, you know, a lot of time growing up. Of course, he lived there up until, you know, 9 or 10 years old, whatever, but they would, you know, go back and visit his grandparents. So his grandparents lived up in Dusseldorf. Kind of toward the north, up in the Ruhrgebiet, which I learned about, the Ruhr industrial area.
Exactly.
And there were no Americans up there, right? There were no posts. There were, you know, it was an American free zone. And we would travel there. We would go up there on weekends to visit his grandmother and just kind of hang out. Düsseldorf was a, you know, pretty cool city.
Mm-hmm.
Up there, though, I did notice. I would get into conversations with some of the local young people up mm-hmm. there, and I would hear, you know, some pretty serious anti-American sentiment.
Uh-huh.
So I guess it kind of depended on what part of Germany you were in. You know, around the Kasern, in any place where there was an American post, mm. I think people were just so used to it that it was just the way it was. You didn't hear anything about it. But elsewhere, I think it was more of an issue with certain people.
Mm-hmm. Well, you submitted a story to the anthology, which is my favorite piece in the whole book, and that's even, and that's going above even mine. I submitted some pieces to the anthology too, and I like yours better. But your story reads partly like a travel piece, and it's partly like a history lesson, and it's got this tinge of wistful nostalgia and melancholy. And I'd like to read a passage from it for our listeners and make a plug for the book. The book will be published later on this year, 2020, and it's called On Freedom's Frontier. But I want to just read this because I think it's beautifully written. So, was it dangerous? Not in a conventional sense. My war was not a shooting war. In the words of the great Michael Herr, my war was a rock and roll war. It was a Led Zeppelin and Pink Floyd kind of war, full of tension and anxiety and doom, where things were not always what they seemed on the surface, potential apocalypse always hovering, waiting to descend with a world-eating vengeance. It was a culture war, a propaganda war, a war of proxies, a war of fear and desire, hope and despair, dreams and nightmares. It was a time and place where one wrong move by a random American teenager on some lonely stretch of the border could set off a diplomatic incident that could have world-shaking consequences. I love this description. So I wanted to ask, what is your writing process, or how do you come up with all of this when you are writing about something like we did, like what we've been talking about?
Well, I don't know that I have a process, to be honest with you. This particular piece, the one that you so generously asked and included in your book, came out of a conversation that I had with a friend of mine here in Nashville, who is a writer. He's a published author.
Mm-hmm.
He's a music journalist. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he's been writing a long time.
Mm-hmm.
It was shortly after I got back from my trip back, which mm-hmm. happened a couple of years ago. I finally went back, you know, all these years. I'd always wanted to go back, and I never could, you know, 4 years later, you know. But somehow or other things just kind of worked out. A couple of years ago, and I went back, finally, my bucket list trip.
Right.
You know? And which was just an unbelievably fantastic experience. But I was, like a month or so after I was back here in Nashville, I was telling my friend about it. And he was like, man, you need to write that. And I'm like, why? He said, it's fascinating. He said, I'm not even into history or the military or any of that, but I'm really interested in what you're telling me. Mm. You got to write it down. And I did. Yeah. I just sat down and wrote it. I'd written, when I was over there during my trip, there were a lot of guys, I mean, you know, several, as I'm sure you are, Facebook groups
right.
of people who were connected, who were stationed over there, right?
Right.
And as a matter of fact, I run a group called Cavland on Facebook. I have for several years, got maybe 3,000 people in it. But anyway, a lot of those guys knew I was going over there, and they said, hey, we keep us updated. You know, it's kind of like, I want to, you know, we want to know what you're seeing.
And, right. Living vicariously. Yeah.
That kind of thing. So I was writing a lot of it. That became this thing that you included in your book, really kind of letting the guys back home know what I was experiencing and seeing.
Uh-huh.
And so I had the germ of it from that. And then that conversation with a friend of mine, and it's like, you need to write it. So I just sat down and wrote it.
Well, it's beautiful, and now it makes sense when I'm thinking about how you were writing it, and you were really going back through the streets and through the places and describing the post and things like that. So you were trying to help your friends in the Cavland Facebook group really experience how it felt. Well, you did a great job on it.
Thank you.
So since this piece, you've been creative with this memoir, you've done a podcast and you're narrating the story and reading it and adding music and sound clips. What is the URL for that podcast? Where can people hear it?
If you go to Cool War, which is kind of like a play on Cold War, coolwar.me, like me, coolwar.me. as opposed to .com, coolwar.me, that's where the podcast is.
Okay, so N-E or M-E?
M as in Mary.
Okay, Mary E. Okay, very cool. Because I've heard it, I thought it was really interesting how you put music and clips of basic training in there. it was good.
Yeah,
so,
thanks.
Yeah. So are you working on any other projects right now?
No. I'm continuing to work on episodes for the podcast. I don't know how many more there will be. I think I've got 6 now. I'm working on another one, as you know, at the moment, which kind of covers my trip to OP Alpha, which is the museum that they've created out of our old border post there. It's an incredible museum.
I've heard it's amazing.
It's world class. I mean, it is just amazing. And I got a beautiful tour of it. You know, they're real interested at the Point Alpha Foundation, which is the nonprofit that runs the museum and other things. They're real interested in talking to people who serve there. And so somebody put me in contact with one of the researchers, a guy named Danny, at OP Alpha.
Right.
And connected us. He wanted to talk to me when I got there, and so I met him, and he gave me a personal tour of the museum and spent time talking about my experience over there and everything. It was just fantastic. So, and I videoed a lot of that when I was over there, so I'm kind of chiseling out an episode that covers that in the podcast, but I might have that up in the next week or so.
Well, I actually met Marion Melber at Point Alpha, the director. Danny put me in touch with her, and so she and I did some collaboration too. I had hoped to be over there at the end of April for the their annual event, but the pandemic kind of DX'd that. So we only have a few more minutes, but I wanted to ask you, what life lesson did you take away from serving in the Cold War?
Well, personally, it is where I as I put it in my writing, it's kind of the final transition between childhood and adulthood.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Those last teenage years there.
Mm-hmm.
Just because of that alone, I mean, it that time and that place and that real specific, odd situation mm-hmm. on the border there, it kind of marked me. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. I think about it every day. I mean, here mm-hmm. I am 51 years old and mm-hmm. I still think about it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But also my time in Germany opened my eyes to the wider world mm-hmm. culturally.
Mm-hmm.
I think it expanded my personal vision of the world probably more so than people who hadn't experienced other cultures in such an intense way. And it really spurred an interest in history,
mm-hmm.
Both military history and otherwise, especially in Europe. It really shaped my worldview permanently to see that border, the Iron Curtain, to see what, to see how bad things can really be. I mean, mm-hmm. An entire continent can be turned into a prison.
Right.
What happens when we allow tyranny to take hold,
mm-hmm.
It's critically important that we never allow that to happen again.
Well, I think that's a good place to wrap this up. That is definitely the life lesson that we took when we visited communist Germany and we never wanted to have something like that happen again. Well, I wanted to thank you, Greg, for talking to me today. Once again, this is Circe Olson Wessner, and I'm the director of the Museum of the American Military Family in Tijeras, New Mexico. And this has been our podcast, Together We Serve. And so I wanted to thank Greg Hallmark very much for talking with us. And I hope that the listeners will go check out your podcast. And when our book comes out on Facebook, I will announce it loud and proud. And they can read 37 other authors' stories on their times on the border. But thanks again, Greg, for taking time today to talk with us.
My pleasure, Circe, and thank you for what you're doing. It's very much appreciated by a lot of people.
Well, thank you.